State Technology and Regulatory Council. Welcome to today's training, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover introductory material in the first few slides, and then I'm quickly going to turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Team. Today's training is based on the Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document. It's a web-based document. We're going to introduce you to the document during the training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're recording today's session, and we will offer the archive after the training. During today's class, trainers control the slides. If you want to control your own slides, you are welcome to download the presentation, and that is available back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. We will have a question and answer break, so we'll ask some of those questions out loud in the middle of the presentation and another at the end of the presentation. We do encourage you to fill out the feedback form at the end of the class. We are developing new courses, and we do use your feedback not only to improve today's offering, but also to make our newer courses better match your needs. The feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. So if you want a certificate, fill out the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way to get the certificate. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, and that's going to allow the system to generate the certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website, which is itrcweb.org. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, it's a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We also have members of industry involved, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use the ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website. You can learn more about what guidance is available. We do have our online training schedule for all of 2018 available. And if you're interested in becoming more involved, there's some new teams that are starting. So you can learn more about what opportunities are available to become more involved in ITRC. I'll introduce our trainers for today. Short bios are available from the CLUIN training page, and we've included a link to that page at the bottom of the slide. All trainers were members of the ITRC Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance Team. On slide 6, I'll now turn the training over to Harold Templin at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Harold?
Hey, Juliana, sorry to interrupt, but I'm on the line. This is Randall.
Thanks, Randall.
Hey, Randall. Hello. Yes, thanks, Juliana. So as we get started today, allow me to set the stage for using statistics to manage your groundwater data and to evaluate it. In my work at the state of Indiana, I've had mounds of data sitting on my desk, and people come by and seem to be concerned as to, well, how do you know what to do and understanding what all this data means and everything like that. And I note that there's some confusion about use of statistics with your groundwater data and what processes you should use. But the use of statistics to evaluate groundwater data demands an adequate evidence of the data quality, sufficient amount of data, and proper data management. So as we go through this training today, you'll be asking the questions of, well, what data should I use? And where do I start with this mound of data? Or what is this data telling me? And how can I make the best use of the data that I have? As we answer these questions, think about using the statistical approach to evaluate your groundwater data. And think about, can a statistical approach really help me in managing my groundwater data? Let me point out a few points here. If you're not a statistician or expert statistician, this training and the online guidance will help you be a more informed consumer of using statistics. Be confident in spotting misapplication and mistakes in using statistics in your selection or review of selection of the different statistical test methods that you might use, and just an overall understanding of the statistical language. And then if you are a statistician, we suggest that this document will also help you make your work and conclusions more understandable to the general audience. So ITRC sees the groundwater statistics and monitoring compliance statistical tools for a project lifecycle document to be the answer for the managing your groundwater data. But instead of using that long term, let's just say the either the web-based document or the GSMC document is going to be your solution. And with that, it'll help you to ask the right questions to apply statistics, direct you to the appropriate statistical method, and help you maximize the value of the data that you have. ITRC formed this team back in 2011, and it's comprised of federal experts from the Department of Defense, the EPA, Department of Energy, along with industry, consulting firms, and then state regulators. This expert team has come together and brought together the information into a usable and accessible web-based document. And we wish to point out that existing regulations will vary across the different states, across different uses of the statistics, and may not recognize advantages or limitations that you might have with current statistical practices. So let me just go over a couple examples pointing that out. So we look at a regulatory challenge example here of meeting a criterion. So we have, after an active remediation, we have these 8 data points taken at quarterly events, and we see this varying data that we have. We have the criterion at 0.5 milligrams per liter, and we may say, oh, well, if we have 2 consecutive values under the criterion, we're okay. And we can see that was an occurrence in June or July and in the fall of 2011. But what certainty do we have that this is the correct decision? And we would suggest that if you would go into the document, you would see that a statistical approach would give you an upper confidence of 0.689 milligrams per liter for the upper value of the confidence of the mean. And as we see, this is a little bit above the confidence limit, so that you might argue or have some means to defend continuing monitoring at this site or starting back up the remediation system to get that mean below the criterion. Another example would be handling or managing non-detect values. What we have here is a long series of data where they went through different labs or had different interference, and as you see, the open boxes are the non-detect values, whereas the closed inboxes are actual reported values, so that we have reported values under some of the detection limits. And so this makes it a very complicated way to manage this data. And if we were just to use a simple substitution method, we would find that possibly we'd have an upper confidence limit around the mean of 0.0125 milligrams per liter. But it, within the web-based document, we talk about using possibly a Kaplan-Meier evaluation in this specific case. And with that, what we're doing is we're evaluating the non-detect values as they are compared to the detected values around them. And we come up with, in this case, of an upper confidence limit around the mean of 0.005 milligrams per liter, which is below the criterion, which was in this case of 0.01. The ITRC document, GSMC document, web-based document, is for project managers for you to help in reviewing or using statistical, when you review or use statistical calculations in reports, or maybe help you in making recommendations or decisions based upon statistics that you've seen, or demonstrating compliance with a groundwater project. What we say is this web-based document is not a how-to document or specific on what you, how you do a statistical method, but it helps you build upon your technical background and environmental experience in site compliance and cleanup. And you can use this web-based document even if you don't have specific expertise in statistics or access to an in-house statistician. And during this training, we're going to show you how. Basically, here we have the roadmap of today's training. And first, we'll discuss how you can use this web-based document. Then we'll set you up with applying the statistics to your data, have a short question and answer period. Then we'll apply different questions dealing with background compliance and so forth, and using statistics, and then we'll come back with a summary of today's training and have another short question and answer period. But basically, first, how this document is built and how you can move around in it is that what we have seen the team has put together is basically during the different project life cycle stages, groundwater statistical methods have an application. And so that whether it's in detection or site characterization, monitoring, or closure, there will be some statistical test that can support the decision making in this part of the life cycle. Then next, we have the study questions. And the team put together these basic common problem statements, which we call study questions, that can decide your decision through the environmental process, so that different study questions may go through different project life cycles. And specifically, you might say, oh, is there seasonality in my groundwater data? So you, if that's your concern, you would click on that. It would take you to that section of the study questions and explain how you might use different methods to answer that question, or what you might use to, when you might use this part of the statistical evaluation in your project. Then lastly, the statistical approach. So what we have is the study questions sort of build a bridge between your different project life cycles and the statistical approach that you might use, whether it be in evaluating the data or the actual statistical methods, or even the software that you would use in coming up with solving your methods or running the different methods. What we have here is the, if you go to the homepage of the web-based document, you have this logo, which you, is interactive. And as you come in to the document, you may want to okay, I want to see what I have to do during this project life cycle. And it would take you to the different life cycle stages and then point you on to different statistical methods or study questions that you might have. Or you might come in with a wanting to know about a specific statistical method, and you can go straight to there, or if you have a specific question. But anyway, in any of these sections are interconnected and will guide you through the rest of the web-based document to give you a better decision for your project. We also want to point out that being a web-based document, it also has links to different resources. One of the more used resources would be the unified guidance, so that if once we have given you a suggested statistical method, it will link you to the unified guidance as to how to calculate that method, how you might use that method. Also, as you remember up front, one of the questions is, what data do I use? Is my data sufficient? This is the DQO process is a way of determining how you know that you have the right data, the quality of data that you have, and the quantity of data that's needed to satisfy a specific use. And so we have links to the EPA process on how to do that. In addition, we have other links to statistical reference textbooks and other guidance documents that are available, ASTM methods. So with that, I think we're ready to apply statistics, and I'll turn it over to Chris Stubbs of Rambo to guide you through that portion.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Harold. In this next section, we're just going to review some of the basic principles of statistics that will help you take advantage of the guidance. And first of all, just a quick definition. I like to think of statistics as the science of drawing conclusions from data. And there's lots of tools in the statistics toolbox that can help us with that, starting with just ways of visualizing the data and getting a general understanding of it, and to more quantitative tools such as being able to separate the signal from the noise. And in our case, the signal is, for example, groundwater concentrations that are associated with a site or site activities, and the noise would be just natural fluctuations that don't have anything to do with the site. We can also use these tools to help us summarize the large-scale behavior. We have a site with a lot of data, and we want to summarize that. We can quantify the uncertainty in our conclusions and hopefully use the tools to make better and more defensible decisions. So we're going to go over some of these examples of some of these concepts. But before we get started with that, we're just going to tell a little crime story. Nothing too serious, luckily. Just a theft of a laptop from an office. And so here's the crime. Here was just a burglary. And luckily, the police were able to apprehend a suspect fairly quickly. And that suspect's name is Mr. Ivan Shifty. And so they brought him before the judge, as the defendant, he pled not guilty. And of course, we in our legal system, assume the defendant is not guilty. And as we'll see later on, this is kind of like a null hypothesis when we're doing a statistical analysis. And the prosecution will present some evidence, trying to show that the defendant is actually guilty. So there could be, in this case, there were some fingerprints found, his fingerprints found on the laptop, and the laptop itself was found in the trunk of his car. So some pretty good evidence. And we need that evidence because in our system, we're trying to prove the guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So we sort of start with this presumption that the defendant is not guilty, And we see if we can accumulate enough evidence to make us change our mind about that. And the reason, of course, we do it is we want to avoid making mistakes, making errors. So, of course, the probably worst error we could make is sending someone who's actually innocent to jail. You might call that a false positive error if you think about statistical approaches. But the other error, of course, we can't forget it about is that if he's actually guilty, but then he goes free, that might be a false negative error. Often when we're making a decision, we're kind of faced with both of these type of errors. But usually, depending on our situation, one of them is more serious than the other. So we want to avoid one of them more than the other one. And it's important to think about that ahead of time. So let's just switch over to back to the groundwater a groundwater example, where we're thinking about these same types of errors in the context of a characterization of a site. So we're in the early phases of the project life cycle, where we're just trying to characterize the site. Usually, we don't know that much about it, so we might go into that assuming that the site is not contaminated because we don't have any real reason to believe it is. Could be called our null hypothesis, sort of what we're thinking when we just go into it is the null hypothesis, and then depending on what we find, we'll try and make a decision based on the data. So this is kind of our conclusion up here after we do some sampling. And then we can basically be right or wrong about what our decision is based on what's really happening at the site. So this column over here is what's actually happened at the site, whether it's contaminated or not. So if we say it's not contaminated, it really is not contaminated. That's correct. But if we say it's not, if it is contaminated when it's not, this would be like this false positive error. And we often assign a probability to that false positive error, which is called the significance level. And you've probably heard people talk about the significance level of statistical tests. And that's just the probability that we are avoiding this false positive error. So we often give it a symbol alpha for that probability. And of course, the other possibility is if the site really is contaminated, and we get it correct, or we can get it wrong. So, if we get it correct, often we call that the that's the power of our approach is how likely we're going to reach this correct conclusion when the site really is contaminated. So. A few more details about that. As I said, we should always keep in mind that there's these two types of errors we might make and think about which one might be more important to us. Statistical significance is you hear a lot about, but that is only concerned with the false positive error. And obviously, we want a small chance of making a false positive error. But this is kind of up to us. I mean, we get to decide what is small. So in many environmental investigations and very common in medicine, we use this 5% significance level. So there's only 5% chance or 1 in 20 chance that we're going to make a false positive error. But in other fields, people want to be more certain. So for example, in physics, when you're doing experiments to identify new fundamental particles, for example, you might have a much more rigorous statistical significance level. And then we can't forget about the other type of error, which is the false negative error. And often people forget about checking this one. So it's a little harder to do. It depends more on your data and the sample size and the type of differences you're looking for. But you want to remember to check this, particularly if your null hypothesis is not rejected by the data. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. All right, so let's go through some of the key aspects of a statistical approach here, just kind of quickly. We want to always start with a conceptual site model because that'll help us with deciding on the proper statistical approaches. Look at the data first in an exploratory fashion, usually just by making some plots so that we can get a sense of what the data are available and what it's telling us. Then we think about our statistical plan. And this could ideally be done before we go out and do sampling, but even if we've already done the sampling, we still need to think about our statistical approach. And then we'll use the data to evaluate statistical evidence and think about uncertainty, and then usually we want to go back and make sure that all of our assumptions are actually met. All right, so starting with the first one there, the conceptual site model, this is something we're probably all familiar with. A CSM, a conceptual site model, is just some sort of a written or graphical expression of the site knowledge, just like what's up with the site. So here we have an example of a landfill located close to a river. You can see the groundwater is flowing under the landfill and discharging in the river. And we have some monitoring wells here, shown by these little red circles with the X in them. And we've measured specific conductance in those wells, and that's just a measure of the amount of dissolved solids in the groundwater. And this sample over here isn't a well, but it's actually a sample from the surface water in the river. This river is a tidally influenced river, so it kind of goes up and down with the tides. So we want to evaluate whether there's been a release from this landfill. And in this example, we'll just look at the specific conductance, but in a real site, of course, you'd look at other things as well. So think about the different approaches we could use for testing this hypothesis of whether there's been a release from the landfill. The first is inter-well testing, where we look at all the different wells together, and we divide them into the ones that are located up gradient of the landfill, the background wells, and then compare those to the ones that are down gradient and see if we see an increase in the down gradient direction. There's another approach that's perhaps a little less common, which is an intra-well approach, which would just look at one well at a time. We would look at one well at a time and divide it into two different time periods. One is a time period maybe before the landfill was there, where there couldn't be affected by any releases. And we could compare that to the data from after, when the landfill was installed. And we could compare those two just within one well. And depending on the conceptual site model, one of these might end up being better. So just going back here, and we kind of see that in this case, because we have this tidally influenced river, for example, this well over here is quite elevated in specific conductance, but that could just be from the river influence, not necessarily from the landfill. So for this example, I would say an intra-well approach would probably be more appropriate. So we would just look at one well at a time and, one of these downgradient wells and make sure that, after the landfill was there, there wasn't a significant increase in specific conductance. All right, so next concept I want to talk about is this exploratory data analysis, which usually just means you should just plot all your data that you have. Take a look at all of it. I've listed kind of the top five plots that tend to be most useful for groundwater analysis, but there are others you might want to consider, in addition to just like mapping your data, of course. And we'll go through examples of these plots, as we get through the presentation here. I'll just go ahead and start with the time series plot, which I'm sure we've all seen, where we look at the concentration, for example, in a well. Here's one showing benzene. And we'll look at how that changes over time to kind of look for trends or maybe see outliers. One just little reminder here is it's very useful to distinguish the non-detect results from the detect results, because sometimes we'll see things like this where, you know, basically the early data here is all non-detect, and there's just been a decrease in the detection limit, but probably no real trend in the data. So that's a good thing to remember. It's good practice to show the detects and the non-detects on those time series plots. Another quite useful, somewhat more specialized statistical plot is a box plot, which is useful for comparing two groups. So, for example, when we're comparing those downgradient compliance wells with the upgradient or background wells, box plot is a good way to try, a good thing to try first. And these box plots, if you haven't seen them, basically they're kind of summarize all the data, and the line here in the middle is the median of the data, and then the upper edge of the box is 75th percentile, and the lower edge is the 25th percentile. And they have these what are called whiskers that go out, which help you see where the bulk of the data is, and any data that's outside of that is a potential outlier, and those are just plotted as the individual data values. So it's a nice plot for showing the central tendency. So you see here that the central tendency represented by the medians is very similar between these two data sets, but you're getting more spread in the compliance data, and there's some outliers that might want to look into in more detail and make sure there's we have good data quality for those. Scatter plot is a good one when you're looking at the relationship between two variables. So if you have a well where we've measured, in this case here, arsenic and mercury in the same well over time, and we want to see, you know, is there a good correlation between those two, you can use a scatter plot to look at that. And here we see a nice linear correlation between the data, as shown by the fact that all the data kind of follow this straight line here. All right, so next thing I wanted to talk about is this statistical sampling plan. So we want to ideally plan ahead of time for the statistical decisions that we're going to want to make. We want to think about the two decision errors that are possible, and design the plan in order to control them or achieve acceptable decision error rates. Often you want to do this prior to sampling because one of the things you need to decide on is the number of samples. That's obviously a key factor in controlling decision errors. So it's good to think about that ahead of time. But even after you've done the sampling, you kind of still have to go back and think about whether you've achieved sufficient statistical power in order to maybe detect an effect that you're interested in. And if you don't have enough samples, then you might not get enough power, and you could kind of get a false negative type of error. The way to think about all this is that there's really some trade-offs that you have to consider. There's the things that you can kind of control here, which is the sample size, for example, and these are the error rates that you can pick, that so you can decide on what's an acceptable error rate for the false negative and false positive errors. And effect size is how big of a difference is important to you. In some cases, you know, you might find some statistically significant effect, but as a practical matter, it's just such a small difference that it doesn't really matter. So you really want to kind of think about what's the kind of practical differences that really make a difference to your site decisions. As Harold mentioned, there's some good guidance in the kind of EPA data quality objectives documents that kind of help work through this, and it's also discussed in the Section 3 of the online groundwater guidance. All right, so now we've got thought about our statistical sampling plan. We've taken our samples, and now we're ready to evaluate that data and consider the statistical evidence for various conclusions. One of the more typical approaches is to use hypothesis testing, which is sort of the approach that similar to that courtroom example, where we develop a null hypothesis. And we consider it versus it's kind of converse, which is called the alternative hypothesis. And we determine whether there's sufficient evidence in our data to reject that null hypothesis. So it takes a little practice to come up with these null hypotheses, because we really tend to think about you set the null hypothesis to generally be sort of the opposite of what you're really interested in. So if your question at the site is, do the site concentrations exceed background, then your null hypothesis would probably be that the site concentrations are consistent with background. In other words, the site concentrations are less than or equal to background. And you'd see whether there's enough evidence to reject that. Another example would be if your question is, have the cleanup goals been achieved, then the null hypothesis would be that the concentrations at the site are above those cleanup goals, so they haven't been achieved. And finally, if your question is, is there a trend in the concentrations, then the null hypothesis might be, there's no trend. In other words, the slope of a trend line is zero, no different than zero. So just go in a little bit more detail about the steps you go through in hypothesis testing after you've defined your hypotheses, like we just discussed. And usually use computer software to help you calculate a test statistic using the data under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. And you get that test statistic, and then you also usually get a p-value, or the probability that what you observed in your data is consistent with the null hypothesis, so that it could have been observed if the null hypothesis was true. So basically, you make the decision by looking at that p-value, and you compare the p-value you got calculated from your data with a significance level that you've selected. So if you've selected a 5% significance level, then you kind of look at that p-value and see if it's less than 5%. And if it's less than 5%, that means it's very unlikely that that data would have been generated by, if the null hypothesis was true, so you can reject it. But if you fail to reject the null hypothesis, you should always remember to look at the power of the test to make sure you actually had enough data to really do a good job of testing that. So, again, these p-values are kind of the key to the hypothesis test. I think another way of thinking about it is they kind of measure the discrepancy between what you observed in your data and what you would expect to see if that null hypothesis were true. And often what we're trying to distinguish is the effects from just natural variability in data from those effects that are actually associated with the site. So the p-value can kind of help us evaluate the strength of the evidence against the null hypothesis, where the lower p-values are stronger evidence, because it's less likely that you could see that data that you've observed, if the null hypothesis were true. All right, so so that's one way of looking at your data. Kind of the other way is just describing the uncertainty in the data when you kind of calculate something like a statistic, like a mean of your concentrations from different wells, and let's just say it turned out to be 5.1, and you're like, well, how reliable is that estimate of the mean? You kind of might think about using statistical intervals to show that, because if your statistical intervals are really wide, meaning there's a lot of variability in your data, then you might not feel as confident in that estimate of the mean. And we've all seen these kind of intervals. They're like error bars on data sets. But there's different types of intervals. Like the most common one are these confidence intervals, or you might put those on the confidence interval on the mean estimates. But there's also prediction intervals and tolerance intervals, and those can be useful in other circumstances. And we'll look at a little bit more in the difference between confidence and prediction intervals in a second. But they're all similar in the sense of they have an associated confidence level associated with the interval, which is the probability that the interval includes the value that you're interested in. So if it's the mean, it's the probability that the interval includes the mean. And as we'll see, we can use these intervals to do something equivalent to a hypothesis test by comparing the intervals to, for example, groundwater protection standards. All right, so a little bit more about these confidence intervals versus prediction intervals. So as I mentioned, confidence intervals show the uncertainty in statistics. So the ways that you've summarized your data is like a mean or a median or a slope of a trend line. Prediction intervals, on the other hand, give you some information of what you might expect if you took some new samples in the future. And you're not comparing a statistic to the prediction interval, but you actually would look at some new data and see how it lines up. So here's an example here. If we've got some samples of total organic carbon in a well, and here's the actual values that we measured. There's all the values. And we can calculate the mean kind of right in the middle here. And you can see the prediction interval, the confidence interval is around the mean, kind of tells us, what's the likely range of that mean given the variability in the data. But the prediction interval, on the other hand, is telling us, well, what might we get if we took another sample? If we took a new sample, what might we expect it to be? And we'd expect it to be in this kind of wider interval here, because it's not a mean, it's actually a new value, and it's sort of like could be, anything similar to what we found before with a little bit extra because there's some uncertainty there. So that's the difference between those. And now we'll just talk about how we might use these approaches in the two different phases of a site. So first of all, we'll think about if we're in the kind of early site characterization phase of the investigation or release detection, and we go in with this null hypothesis, kind of go in assuming the site's clean unless we get some evidence otherwise. So our null hypothesis would be, let's say, for example, that the mean concentration of the site is less than the MCL, or the maximum contaminant level. And then, of course, the alternative hypothesis would be the converse of that. So we can use confidence intervals on the mean to do a little hypothesis test here. So we can reject the null hypothesis if our lower confidence limit on the mean is greater than the MCL. So the lower confidence limit is kind of like the smallest the mean could possibly be. And if that's greater than the MCL, then we know we're pretty sure that the site has some contamination. All right, now if we're kind of in the other side of things where we're doing some corrective action or remediation, now we're like, well, we know the site's contaminated, so we want to make sure that we've cleaned it up enough to be certain that we're below the cleanup level. So here, our null hypothesis is that the mean concentration of the site's greater than or equal to the MCL. And if we want to kind of test that as a statistical test using the confidence intervals, we would reject that null hypothesis if the upper confidence limit on the mean is less than the MCL, because then we're pretty sure that we've achieved the MCL. All right, so that's just how you can use confidence intervals to do something very similar to hypothesis tests. So finally, we'll just talk about some of the assumptions that many statistical methods have and how you might kind of test for them. The first one's your outlier. We kind of see a good example of an outlier here where we've got a plot with some concentration data. There's this one point that's, most of them are non-detect, and this one non-detect's just way out of line with the others. So, we want to go back and make sure that that's accurate, and that there wasn't like a transcription error or something like that. But generally, if we can't find anything wrong with it, we should include it in our analysis. But we might, in some cases, try the analysis both with and without that potential outlier and see how significant it is to our conclusions. Another very common thing we need to test is statistical distributions. So many times we use methods that require the assumption that our data follow a standard distribution. It could be like the normal distribution, a log normal, and sometimes we'll use a gamma distribution. So if we're using a parametric method, That essentially means that the method requires the data follow a particular distribution, so we should make sure to test it. If we find that it doesn't follow the distribution or for whatever reason we don't want to use a parametric method, we can use non-parametric methods that don't rely on this assumption. So a nice way of just testing the distribution is with using graphical approaches. So you can just do a simple histogram. So here we're looking at a histogram that generally shows, kind of a bell-shaped symmetrical curve. So we could kind of say, well, this generally follows a normal distribution. And also a more specialized statistical plot, which is called a probability plot. And if we plot the data on there and the data follow a straight line, as they do here, then we can also conclude that they're consistent with that distribution. So graphical approaches are generally sufficient for most of our work that we do. Other assumptions that we have to think about are statistical independence. So we usually are assuming that our data are spatially and temporally independent from each other. So that means we don't want to sample too often. We don't want to sample, take one sample one day and then take another sample the next day and count those as two separate samples because, you know, they just would not be statistically independent. So it wouldn't be fair to count those as separate samples. And similarly, if the samples are too close in space, those would also not be independent. So we want to kind of think about that, make sure we're not overcounting our number of independent samples. Another assumption is that if we're looking at the background concentrations, that they don't have that there's no trend in the background. So we often want to make sure we test the trends in background and make sure that there's nothing changing over time. So here's an example where we obviously have concentrations increasing over time. So we might need to either select a different background data set or actually you can kind of remove this trend and use the detrended data in some cases. All right, so finally, just some closing thoughts. Just a reminder to always plot your data. That can be very useful in almost all cases. To think about these different decision or these different error rates associated with their decision and make sure you have a sufficient data to reach a good decision. Sometimes you might have to go out and collect more data. You always need to confirm the regulatory requirements. They're quite different states and different programs. So you want to make sure that you're following those, you do the right statistical testing approaches. You want to always combine the statistical analyses with other lines of evidence. Another way of saying that is, if you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything. So we don't want to just use statistical tests to make our conclusions. We want to make sure that whatever conclusions we have are also consistent with, hydrogeology and physical principles, and most importantly, with our conceptual site model that we've developed for the site. So with that, we have a question and answer break.
Thanks, Chris. This is Juliana. Anyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you can ask a question out loud. Before we get to those questions, I do have a couple reminders. One, if you leave before we wrap up, we could really use your feedback. So in the related URLs, that second item down, that takes you to the feedback form. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you'd like a certificate, be sure to fill out the feedback form, check the bottom to certify that you attended, and then submit. And the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. Because right now, the only way to get that certificate is by filling out the feedback form, checking the box, and then submitting the feedback form. Also, we have coming up an online training next week on geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites. And in the related URLs, the fourth one down allows you to go to our training page for that and also to register for that. So I do encourage you to review that information. It's a great class, and you're welcome to attend next week to that online training class. We also have a couple of poll questions here as we're going through our first question and answer break, or just one, I guess. For the areas where you could use statistics on your projects, select all that apply: background, compliance, trend analysis, monitoring, optimization. So this is select areas where you have used statistics on your project. And you may need to scroll down to see all of the options. And we do have those set so that as people answer the questions, you can see the answers as they're coming in. So again, anyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. One question that's come in, are you aware of a statistical package that can automatically change the data symbol on a time trend plot for the varied non-detect limits?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not aware of something that's going to do that totally automatically. And, you know, for example, if you're using Excel, it kind of takes a little bit of work because you have to kind of divide the data into two different series, so you kind of have different symbols. So certainly some of the packages make it easier, but I think you kind of have to be kind of aware of that and do a little bit of extra work to get it to show up nicely so you can distinguish those detects from non-detects.
I also have input on that. I think that many times a lot of software packages will do that if you have the data correctly set up, so that if you have an extra column that says detect, non-detect, then you could even in Excel say, well, if it says it is detected, then you fill it in, or if it's non-detect, you leave it blank. So I think I'm not sure of any software that can handle that, but instead it's more how you put the data into the software package.
How is temporal statistical independence determined?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, basically you can look at the correlation between your samples over time. So, you know, if you're if you have a temporal correlation, then samples that are closer to each other in time will tend to be more correlated with each other than those that are farther away. So there's some statistical tools that can help you look at that. But the general idea is that you see things that are really, you know, sampled close together in time look much more alike than those that are farther away. You know, for groundwater investigations, you can also think a little bit just about the you know, groundwater flow velocity, because if you know, the groundwater is flowing really quickly, that might lead you to sample. You know, you can sample more frequently than if it's moving really slowly. So you kind of can think about that as well.
In the federal CCR rule, a minimum of 8 groundwater samples are required. In some very tight formations with low hydraulic gradients, this ends up sometimes questioning the independence, but the rule requires the minimum of 8 samples over a specific time period. Is there any guidance in situations like this?
Yeah, I don't really have any specific knowledge of that federal rule. I mean, I guess if you have to have 8 samples, then you have to have 8 samples. But when you're, you know, analyzing them, I guess you could take into account the fact that they are perhaps not independent, and note that. But I don't know if others have any, you know, more specific advice on that question.
We'll go on with
Well, I was just going to agree with Chris that you know, the rule is what the rule is, but as I pointed out, that you still can do a statistical test to show that possibly they're not independent, and so that would maybe shadow what the results were from that finding. So, I mean, it's important, even if the rule says to do it this way, to look at it in a correct statistical way to see if you have lines of evidence to say, well, that isn't the way to do it.
What do you think of the use of USDPA Pro UCL version 5.1 for conducting these statistical analysis?
Yeah, I guess so. Pro UCL is a software package that was developed by an EPA contractor, so it's freely available, and it does do, you know, many of the statistical tests and plotting and all so forth that's discussed in the guidance. I guess to say, in my experience, it's not 100% reliable because it's you know, it's not a professionally published software package that's been perhaps as extensively checked as others, so I'd be a little bit cautious in some cases with the results. But generally, I think it does, you know, everything that you might be interested in, and it is freely available.
Chris mentioned graphical methods that are generally adequate to determine distribution. What if the data do not necessarily fit the straight line or histogram? What would you recommend to further assess?
Yeah, so you can, you know, if you do the graphical approach and you kind of see that, for example, if you're doing a probability plot and the data don't really follow the line that well, you know, you can get more quantitative and conduct a hypothesis test to look at, you know, how consistent the data are with that distribution. But basically, I think if you find that just looking at it graphically and it's kind of not following the distribution, that you might as well just move on to using non-parametric tests that don't rely on that assumption. And it just as a general practice, you could just tend to use both just to kind of verify that you're getting similar results with both parametric and non-parametric approaches. But generally, yeah, I think, you know, just kind of eyeballing it is sufficient to tell you. And you know, if it doesn't really fit, then you should probably just move on to the non-parametric methods.
As a rule of thumb, do you find that volatiles and metals generally follow normal or log normal distributions?
Yeah, I mean, I think log normal distributions tend to work pretty well with most chemical concentrations. If you want a little bit more flexibility, you can use the gamma distribution, which is kind of similar to the log normal, but just a little bit more flexible, kind of fit, I would say, most situations. But usually those three will work for most of analyses that I've seen, unless it's just you know, something really strangely distributed, in which case you'd use the non-parametric approaches.
Any particular plot that is more useful than others, i.e., best presentation of data that is used by statisticians?
Yeah, I guess I don't know if there's a best one, but I would say, you know, if you're comparing groups of samples, that, you know, box plots are kind of the standard statistical approach, and I guess those could probably be used more often in environmental work, because I don't often see them. And there's kind of some slightly fancier versions of box plots that show, you know, the distributions a little bit better. But, you know, I guess that would be my choice for the sort of most underused plot that might be beneficial for people to consider.
How could you use a preliminary report about groundwater contaminated sites with hydrocarbons to determine a sample or a number of samples to take to finish treatment?
The number of samples to take to finish treatment. Well, you know, I guess in general, you know, you're trying to, you have to sort of figure out what your criteria is for declaring that, you know, it's treatment has been sufficient. You know, I guess the complication is in some cases you might be comparing your data to a particular concentration threshold, but in other cases, the cleanup criteria might be more something along the lines of reaching an asymptote in reduction. So in other words, there doesn't seem to be any benefit in continuing the remediation because there's no real significant decline observed in the data after that. So, you know, so for the first case where you're actually comparing to a target concentration, you know, there's some good guidance from EPA and in the online guidance about, you know, how to select the appropriate number of samples to achieve certain, you know, false positive and false negative error rates. And then, of course, if you're looking at reaching an asymptote, you know, you're kind of trying to test the trend in the data to see if there's any trend, so you could kind of take that approach on there. So, you know, the details of both those cases are described in the online guidance. There's also in the back is some good examples where we kind of looked at those types of problems and have a kind of a worked example of how you go through it.
We have time for just a couple more questions. Could you explain the value of field duplicates? What do you do with the data when they don't agree?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the purpose of a field duplicate is to help you assess the variability of, you know, your sampling approach. So, you know, so the first thing you would do is look at the differences between those, you know, the original sample and the field duplicate to kind of get a sense of, you know, how much variability you have in that sampling. So, of course, if it's too much variability, then you might help you or might lead you to take additional samples to account for that. But after you've kind of, you're getting to the point where you want to actually analyze the data, usually what I do is just take the two duplicates or the original sample and the field duplicate, and I just average them together because they're not independent samples, of course. And then I use the average value as the actual sample point for that location in further analyses. So I know in some guidance it suggests doing different things, but that's generally what I do in order to account for the fact that the two wouldn't be independent.
Any general suggestions on how to represent non-detect values, i.e. half of the MDL or zero or?
Yeah, that is a topic that's addressed in some detail in the guidance, and there's been quite a bit of work on this topic. Of course, traditionally, people would just substitute, you know, for example, half the detection limit in, and then continue with the data analysis, pretending like, you know, that non-detect was just the same as all the other samples. But it has been recognized that that introduces quite a bit of bias in some cases in the conclusion. So the sort of recommended approach now is to use this Kaplan-Meier method, which actually accounts for the fact that the you know, the sample is a non-detect and it represents a kind of a less than value. And you can use that Kaplan-Meier approach in, you know, some of the software packages, for example, ProUCL does it. And that would be the more rigorous and recommended way of accounting for non-detects.
Thank you. We do need to wrap up this question and answer break, but we should have more time at the end of the training class to address more questions. So feel free to continue to send in questions throughout the second half of the training. I do want to mention our poll results. Select the areas where you use statistics on your projects, and you got to select all that apply. And it looks like trend analysis is our top answer. Also, background and compliance are also very popular answers. And monitoring optimization is another answer that we had, or another option that we had available here. So we are going to talk about all of these topics in the second half of our training class. So even if you haven't used some of these before, they may become things that you are interested in doing. Also, a reminder, if you leave before we wrap up today, we do appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the feedback. You can access the feedback form from that related URLs in the middle. It's the second one down. Select feedback form and then look down a bit, select that browse to button, and that's going to open that form in a new window. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for attending today. So please be sure to fill out the feedback form. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of the training class, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Liz Simmons at Kleinfelder.
Thanks, Juliana. We're now going to present some different examples of the application of statistics to groundwater sites. So in the next few sections, we're going to go through some study question applications and use the project life cycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that Harold and Chris just presented that could apply to some typical questions that might be asked. Now, because of the time involved, we won't be able to cover all the questions in the training, but what we want to do here is just kind of give you a flavor of what's in the guidance document. If you want to get into further discussions of all the study questions, they're actually found in Appendix C of the document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we'll use the project life cycle stages and study questions to illustrate the connections to some hypothetical sites. These questions were developed by the team to easily navigate through typical issues and questions that may come up during various phases associated with the groundwater monitoring and also ways to evaluate the data. In the table at the left, we show the project life cycle stages, this time as columns. The study questions are listed at the right. And these study questions generally apply to each of the life cycle stages, and they're noted by X's in the table on the left. In the guidance document, this is the main tool we use to connect between the cycle stages and study questions, and this is used to help the reader find information that's relevant for their particular site. The first concept we're going to discuss is background. And for background, study questions 1 and 2 are applicable. For study question 1, what are the background concentrations applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question 2, are concentrations above background applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So what is background? Sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state, but what we're talking about here is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, a baseline has to be established because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of the contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what may be considered a pristine standard. And the web-based guidance document addresses this in more detail. Background is usually tied to some sort of regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like an MCL, a risk-based criterion, or some other threshold. Back on slide 31, Chris discussed intra-well versus inter-well, and consider it as a time-only relationship versus a time-space relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times. So what you're looking at is essentially a before, if possible, a during and after contamination picture. And natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. For inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells. You're generally comparing what you're considering as, you know, like an upgradient or a background well with downgradient compliance wells. So here you're evaluating samples over both time and space. So when we're evaluating background, what do we need to consider? First of all, we need to consider known sources. how many sources are not related to site contamination. We need to try to avoid these. We need to look at distance and direction and geologic, hydrogeologic information. For example, estimated groundwater gradient, fracture flow, and evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data. We need to look at multiple aquifer characteristics. For example, do you have a perch zone? Do you have multiple aquifers? If so, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate. And data quality objectives. These are important. These should be developed up front. You need to get a sufficient number of samples to provide reliable results, and you need to examine the quality of your data set. For example, do you have multiple detection limits? Basically, what you need here is to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of your assumptions. As Chris talked about in his previous segment, we should use exploratory data analysis methods to help evaluate potential background data sets. And this is discussed in detail in sections 3.3.3 and 3.5. An initial step would be to simply inspect the data to determine the frequency of detection, representativeness of samples, whether there's one or multiple detection limits, the time span of the data, can some of the data be too old, and the consistency of analytical methods. For example, if you've got BTEX, you know, over the history of the site, it may have been analyzed by EPA methods 80-20, 80-21, or 80-260. And to get a quick visual, you know, it's best to use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, or scatter plots to plot the data set to provide some sort of insight into the overall spread and potential distribution of the data. And for determination of the distribution of the data set, to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where it doesn't necessarily fit a normal distribution, or you may not have enough samples to work with. And also, which statistical methods will be needed in your evaluation of background. For example, a t-test is a parametric method and is sensitive to outliers. Most regulatory governance, for example, RCRA, requires establishment of background. And this example shows how potential background well data can be evaluated to determine whether a particular data set can be used to characterize background. This example applies to study question one, what are the background concentrations, and also to study question two, which is are concentrations greater than background concentrations. For study question one, we're going to use descriptive statistics, and we'll use inferential hypotheses in study question two. This example site shows a hypothetical metal recycling site where arsenic is the primary chemical of concern, and a groundwater plume has been characterized. For this site, the conceptual site model has been completed and validated. The hydrogeology has been studied, and based on that hydrogeology, these are the upgradient wells. Wells 1 and 2 are the upgradient wells. Wells 7 and 8 have been designated and determined to be your side gradient wells. And wells 3, 6, 5, and 4 have been evaluated to be your downgradient wells based on that conceptual site model. The objective that we're looking at here is to identify a data set that would be consistent with background. And we first would select a potential data set and then evaluate the quality. The shape and distribution of the data set are also important. So, what are the data quality objectives and how do they apply to the number of samples required? Are there non-detects that have to be addressed, and does the data have a stable mean and a variance, or are there some sort of trends? Are there outliers, and what's the distribution? This is what we need to look at when we're selecting a data set. Here we've selected a data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells over a two-year period. For our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. And in this particular data set, there's no non-detects. Both upgradient wells are also below the MCL. So let's take a look at this particular slide, because there's a number of methods and tools that do preliminary statistical analysis. For example, you can do probability plots or time series plots. And for interpretation of results, you need to understand the source of variation, whether it's natural or man-made. You need to look at the environmental settings. You can look for information from research or published studies. You also need to look at temporal changes, your rainy seasons versus your dry seasons, and also the presence of outliers. Then, based on your analysis and interpretation, does your conceptual site model need to be revised? And just remember, the conceptual site models are living documents, and if there appears to be another upgradient source, you need to update your conceptual site model. In this case, based on the graphical methods that we've used, well W1 appears to be fairly consistent with that expected for a background well, where W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Upon further research, we determined that those 2 points both occur in April, where there's a larger runoff from the mountains, where there are higher arsenic concentrations in the rocks. And therefore, both of these can be considered background wells. More often, though, a specific reason for the outliers isn't known. And this is where statistical methods can come in handy in being able to manage the outlier data. All right, next we're going to discuss how statistics applies to monitoring compliance. For monitoring compliance, we move to study questions 3 and 4. For study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. For study question 4, when will that criterion be met applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. Now, because of the time constraints we have here, study question 4, we're not going to address this in this internet-based training, but as I said previously, it is the question is described in detail in the guidance document. Why do we do monitoring and evaluate site characterization? To evaluate site characteristics, and site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of both spatial and temporal data. We also evaluate for chemical concentrations to evaluate compliance with groundwater protection criteria. For monitoring design, we need to look at a couple of things. What are your potential contaminants? Have they changed over time? For example, if you've got chlorinated hydrocarbons, you can have, PCE to TCE to vinyl chloride. This identifies a release or can identify a release and assists us in developing a conceptual site model. And in most cases, it's also to maintain compliance with regulatory requirements. The basis of monitoring compliance and groundwater criteria compliance can be varied. You can have an MCL. It can be background. You can have some sort of risk-based value based on an exposure scenario, or you can have an eco-protection value. And compliance measures should be presented in a quality assurance project plan. For example, the number of samples you're going to need. You need to look at the distribution, whether it's parametric, normal, or log normal, versus non-parametric, where, once again, it doesn't fit the normal distribution, or you may not have enough samples. Regulatory thresholds. This can vary depending on, what compliance criteria you are addressing. And the compliance point, which, based on that criteria, can be a number, a maximum limit, or some sort of set value. Here's our data set for wells W3 through W6. And it has the same number of samples and date ranges as we saw for wells W1 and W2, and it meets our data quality objectives. Once again, there's no non-detects in this data set. It is metals. And also note that the data set presented above mimics an actual laboratory data set where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on their threshold detection limits. Based on our conceptual site model, once again, for some reason this is not advancing. There we go. Based on our site model, W3 is closest, W6 is next, W5 goes down, and W4 is the farthest away. So as we're looking at this, is the site in compliance? And to kind of take a look at this, the first thing you may notice is the samples from wells W2 and W6, which are the two closest wells. The samples from W3 are 6 to 9 times the MCL. And samples from W6 are about twice the MCL, but there's less variation in the data than you see in well W3. Now, moving on, let's take a look at samples 5 and 4. Samples from W4 are all below the MCL and are fairly consistent, while samples from well W5 straddle both sides of the MCL and have a slightly larger spread. So if we're looking at all of these for wells W3, W4, and W6, you may not need statistics. That may be true, but it's also a misconception. There's always uncertainty in the results, and the real usefulness here are in the sample from results from well W5, which is the much harder case. Now, Chris previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his segment. And as we're evaluating the data for these four wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And these are also discussed in more detail in the guidance document. There's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they bind a single population. The mean or average is a typical confidence measure. And the mean is shown here in the horizontal colored lines for the various, the horizontal color lines for the various wells. And for example, the mean for W3 is set in green, and the mean for well W4 is set in blue. And the mean is based on multiple observations so that a decision can be made for statistical confidence. For example, one point doesn't prove that the mean or max is below a certain criterion, and one above doesn't necessarily violate that criterion. Now let's look at the vertical arrows here. The vertical black arrows show the confidence interval on the mean for the three different well sets. For example, the variability of the confidence interval for the green one, again, is greater than that for the set confidence interval for the W4 sample set that we have below. Confidence intervals can also be measured around other things, such as an upper percentile, a median, and percentiles can vary too, depending on your risk tolerance, but 90, 95, 99 are typical values. And the number of samples required to calculate the confidence interval for your site should also be based on the data quality objectives that you set up front. And there should be a sufficient number of samples to compensate for variability of data, uncertainty, false negatives, and false positives. Now, one of the things I haven't mentioned previously is that this particular site happens to be in Washington, the state of Washington. And since it's in Washington, we must use the guidance that's been designed by the state. And it should be noted that this is one method, and it does not match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what this particular state has chosen. In the guidance document, we talk about regulatory barriers for various states. And Harold's also mentioned this previously, in his section. After we go through the Washington State guidance, we'll also do an example of this project as a record site that uses the unified guidance. And these two examples are given to illustrate how results of statistical analyses are used and that they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. What you need to know is that CLEAN will most likely be based upon a state-prescribed basis that may or may not be statistically based. And in this example, data from wells were evaluated using the State of Washington Compliance Test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% upper confidence limit, or UCL. So there's three criteria for the State of Washington Compliance Test. And the first one is the upper 95% confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard? And for well W3, W6, and W5, the answer is no. And for well W4, the answer is yes. The second criteria is the maximum data point value less than 2 times the cleanup standard. So for wells W3 and W6, that answer is no. And for wells W5 and W4, that answer is yes. And finally, are 10% of the data above the cleanup standard? And for wells W3, 6, and 5, that answer is yes. And for well W4, that answer is no. So if we look at it based on the State of Washington guidance, wells W3, W6, and W5 are not in compliance, and well W4 is in compliance. So the main question here is, if concentrations remain above the groundwater protection criterion, then when will the site be in compliance? As referenced in our guidance document, when looking at a RCRA situation based upon 40 CFR 264.99, the US EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. So let's take a look at the same site based on that guidance. As Chris described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration, and the appropriate statistical test is the null hypothesis with the mean less than that groundwater protection criterion, where the mean is assumed to represent the true mean concentration. And here we conclude that a well is in compliance when the lower confidence limit, or the LCL, of that mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. In other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within that confidence interval that we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. In the table above, we calculate the 95% confidence interval for the mean of the concentrations for each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. To evaluate that distribution, you may also use distributional tests, and these are described in Section 5 of the online guidance, to figure out if your data follow a distribution. And look at the assumptions in your test. Then compare the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter. And when the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL, we concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, wells W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and well W4 and W5 are in compliance. Now, keep in mind that in this assumption, we're looking at this from a release detection perspective, where the null hypothesis is that the well's in compliance. If the groundwater protection criterion falls below the upper confidence limit, then the null hypothesis will not be rejected unless the groundwater protection criteria is also below the lower confidence limit to be sure that background exceedances don't predetermine any relationship of those increases versus the groundwater protection criteria. Now, if we're looking at a remediation or corrective action scenario, then the null hypothesis is actually reversed. Again, you know, we just wanted to demonstrate the differences between the regulatory frameworks here. So now I'm going to turn the time over to Randall Wrighty, and he's going to talk about trend analyses. Randall?
Yeah, thank you, Liz. So we have our next-to-last topical area here coming up on trend analysis. And if we go back to the poll results, so we saw that was, I think, the most frequently used of these areas by people on the call today. And that's what we see generally, and that's because people have data collected over time, and that's and for groundwater wells, and it's just natural to apply trend analyses. And so people have used it a lot. So I think that's one thing to point out here in terms of using the web-based guidance document is that if you're familiar with the methods, it's sometimes good to get a refresher or see another explanation for the method. Also to see if you're using something you're not really familiar with, what the assumptions are, just verify that data are correct. And if you need to explain with colleagues or other people, you know, what the methods are, you can refer them to some of the materials in the web-based guidance document. Okay. So there are four study questions we've identified that are related to trends. And note that question eight is a spatial trend, and we're not going to cover that today in this training. I refer you to section 5.15 in the web-based guidance document for information on spatial trend analysis. Okay, well, again, you heard this before, but the first thing that you do is plot your data. And when we're looking at plotting your data, scatter plot's obvious choice. In this case, we have an example with an analyte measured over about 3 years. And we have all detected data in this case, which is nice. And we can see there's a trend kind of in these data. Look at the concentrations are going up. They kind of go down. They're almost somewhat typical looking. Well, if you have data like this, what you want to do is apply trend analyses. In this case, we just used simple linear regression, and people have asked about software tools a lot. And there's a lot of different tools that you can use to get the best fit line for this for these data. And what this gives you is information on the the direction of change. In this case, it's increasing, and the rate of change, how much it's changing per year. Okay, well, what applications do we have? I know that it's used frequently in groundwater data just because groundwater data are collected over time. So we already talked a little bit, and Chris mentioned this about background levels, and certainly applies to the example Liz went through. Exploratory data analysis might help you determine are background levels stable. And this is a statistical term people may have heard, independent and identically distributed. And this is one of the basic assumptions that you have when you're looking at background, is that your background data are not changing over time. And this can really influence things like intra-well testing as well as inter-well testing. If you can think of a case where before and after, it's the intra-well testing. If there was an overall trend over time, then you'd be coming to some incorrect conclusions with that. So that's very important to look at that. Then some other examples, we're looking at release detection. We wanted to see if concentrations are steadily increasing or increasing with some other trends in there. Is, are we going to have time for monitor natural attenuation? Is there a decreasing trend? Is it reasonable? How long will it take? And lastly, optimization is another area where we might be looking at trend analyses. And is it really an appropriate sampling effort? And we're going to talk about that in the next section in some detail. Well, what about an example? So this is also giving you another feature of the web-based guidance document is we have Appendix A has some examples illustrating some of the methods. And so this is one of them. This is example A.2. And so this is a hypothetical data set that we created for illustration. And this is showing, again, a scatter plot over time. In this case, we have a longer time series. We have about 12 years of data. And the data you can see are varying quite wildly here. If we look at the scale, first thing is to make sure that you look at the scale, and it's actually a log scale. So it's going over about two orders of magnitude difference in concentration from the low to high. And you look at the original data on this log scale, and it's varying a lot. It's going up and down. The trends are not exactly clear when you have that wider range and concentration. And so one of the things we're doing with this example is actually illustrating how you can go from the original data, which are these circles, to what we're coming up with, the adjusted data. And so the adjusted data is actually taking this autocorrelation, somebody asked already about that, in the data into account. And so one thing you can look at to help simplify this is, let's just highlight the sample that's collected in October. And if you can just visually focus on the filled circles now, you can see, oh, I see a little bit of a trend now within those circles. So basically what the method does is it goes through and it looks at these different sampling events, and it's looking at these sampling events as a factor. If you think about analysis of variance, there's an event in there's a January event, there's an April event, there's a July event, and there's an October event. The October event tends to be the highest value. And that was what you'd identify, is that there's a difference between the different months and what concentrations you see. And then what it can use is then this overall mean value. So look at that, it's plotted here. This is the overall mean over this period of time. And then it's going to take and make the adjustment based on what you see is the difference between what's typical for, in essence, for October versus what we have from the mean. And it's going to then come up with this new, the red line, the solid line here in the middle is the adjusted number. And so this is an interesting approach, and it can be used in groundwater analysis quite commonly, because there is seasonality in the data set. And basically what it also is doing is it's telling you that these seasons are actually behaving quite differently. In essence, there's a season where there are high concentrations and a season of low concentrations, maybe with more dilution during that period of time. So that's pretty important to understanding your data. And in essence, it's indicating these data are not really independent. Okay. Well, let's go on to what else we can do. So now we've taken the same data set, so it's continuing on this with example 8.2 in Appendix A. Now we're just showing the adjusted data here on this plot, and we're illustrating how we might fit regression models to this line. And just for illustration purposes, we've fit the tilt-send line using the nonparametric method and compared it to what we got with linear regression. So again, these data are log normally distributed. So when we do the logs, that's what we're fitting with the linear regression as log linear regression. And we can see that the two lines are very similar. And this is just to illustrate the two different methods and what you'll get when you're doing an evaluation of your data. And if you could say, in my data fit a log distribution, you would use a log linear model. You don't get to pick and choose which one you pick, but you would use that as the more appropriate method for these data. And so I think after looking at the original data and then going to the adjusted data and fitting a model to it, now you can illustrate the trends in your data more clearly. Okay, what about another example? So this is a little bit shorter period of time. We have about 2.5 years of data, and we're just illustrating concentrations, in this case, of TCE over time, and we've collected samples about every other month. And the other thing we're illustrating here again is using a nonparametric method, using the tilt-send line to illustrate the overall trend in the data. So tilt-send line is in the middle. Another thing we've talked about before is confidence bounds. And so the confidence bounds in this case are this dotted lines above and below the line, and they illustrate the 90% confidence in this overall trend. And so if we're interested in understanding at one point in time, are we confident that the trend is below the cleanup level, which is the solid green line, then we can look at the confidence bounds. Well, here's the first point in which it's below it, but then actually the first point is that's below the line is now with 90% confidence bound is below line is at this point in time. So this is just illustrating a case where we have we're interpolating. We have a time series of data. We're just saying within this time period, what have we observed and what conclusions can we draw statistically within this time period? And so this is kind of meant to distinguish between, now this next example is where you might be more interested in looking. You're looking into projecting trends into the future. And this is extrapolation. So here we have a model. So we fit, again, a model. It's a log linear model to the data over this period of time. So it's, again, the data we have from example 8.2 in Appendix A. So we're looking over this period of time, and that's where we have our data. And so that where we're looking, we'll look in the future and say, well, at what point in time might we reach this cleanup goal? And so the cleanup goal is down here, the solid green line again. So if you look at this, here we have kind of our data. So this is important looking at. This is where the center of our data is, way over here. And then we're looking at the different time periods in which we might be looking at. And so we're looking at time periods that go from about 2020 to after 2060. So if you think about this and think about what we're estimating here is that what's uncertain in the model is this slope. So the slope might be a little bit steeper or it might be a little bit shallower. That's really the model we're estimating. It's that simple. It's really, you know, it's basically the slope. And you compare that to what you've seen with other examples looking at like hurricane force forecasting. Yeah, the predictions in the future, the bounds get increased, and it's because there's uncertainty in the direction and path and all the other factors of a hurricane. In this case, it's pretty simple. We just have a model estimating the slope of, you know, concentration change over time, and that's going to lead to some, you know, range in estimates of when you might reach this goal, this cleanup goal in the future. Okay, well, let's now turn to the last topic, which is the monitoring optimization information. And so here we have a couple of questions, study questions that are related to monitoring optimization, and basically they're relating to the adequacy of the sampling frequency and adequacy of the spatial coverage, which is really, you know, the number and placement of wells. Okay, well, one other thing I'll note here, too, is that there's another team that's doing related work, and it's called Geostatistics for Remediation Optimization. And you may have seen a course offering for that or may have taken that already, but they go into a lot more detail in some of the spatial methods for evaluating data and also optimizing your sampling efforts. So that's well worth it if you have some time and interest in this topic. But basically, the optimization is trying to make sure that you have the adequate data, you know, the right amount of data for making decisions. Obviously, if you collect more data, you can refine your estimates more. But at some point, there's a, you know, point of diminishing returns is, in essence, the idea in optimization. And it's finding the point in which you don't really get any more information by collecting more data. And so some of that is when Chris was talking about sampling frequency, think about, well, if I sample, you know, every day, I don't really get more data. I don't get more data to evaluate the overall trends because the data are too tightly spaced over time. And the other way of looking at that is just to look at the correlation between results or the redundancy in sample results. And again, to make sure we have adequate data for accurate decisions. And so this implies that you have gone through, you know, something like a data quality objectives process, so you know why you're collecting data, what questions you're trying to answer with your data collection. Well, let's first look at temporal optimization. And again, so what's the idea here? Are you trying to find out if the sampling event each quarter is independent or not? And like the example we had, we might have seasonality. And so you might think that there is the sampling events in the spring will be related to the sampling event the next spring. And so that's where we would have the statistical terminology is that, you know, spring is correlated, autocorrelated to itself over time. So there's a like basically a lag of 1 year. You see basically the same results. So the strategy is to, you know, try to minimize this correlation, recognize that there is correlation in your data, but still capture overall trends. Like if you have a decreasing trend, you want to capture that. And so this kind of gets into also the question about, you know, what kind of sampling are you doing? It can be phase sampling, where you can sample more intensively for a period of time, and then you can then reduce the amount of sampling. And also the conventions, and some of these may be based on regulations. You just have to collect the data, and if the regulation requires a certain event, you know, monthly sampling, but those turn out to be basically giving the same result, that's something the statistical analysis would help you determine as well. Okay, well, how about an example, again, from the web-based guidance document. So this case, it's example 8.4. And so this is illustrating a method called iterative thinning. And so like a lot of, you know, these analyses, you can imagine doing this manually or by hand. And so what you have in this case is a data set over time. And so it's these smaller circles. Here are the sample results over time. And what this model, this approach does, is actually first thing it does is it fits a model to the data. So this is fitting a smooth data set to this model. And that's these circles that are filled. Larger circles that are filled are the interpolated, the smooth data. And then again, with a lot of other things, we have confidence intervals. So we have fit the data, and we have a confidence interval. That's what the blue lines are. And what the objective of the iterative thinning is to try to capture this overall trend in your data. And you can take out, they could take out every fourth sample, which would give you, you know, basically once a year in this case. Or you could take out once every, you know, one out of, you know, take out all, you know, 7 out of 8, and that gives you just one sample every 2 years. And so you can apply different levels of thinning, and what the software does is it runs through these combinations and determines, well, how many can I remove and still capture the same trend? And so the answer, this was done using the Visual Sampling Plan software, and so the answer we got with Visual Sampling Plan was, well, you could sample once every 227 days was the optimal solution. So basically that's sampling twice a year. So that's good, but one of the things and the reason why I put, we had two examples in the document, the reason why I gave this one was that there's points here that are below this fitted line, the model line, and so in essence, they're outside of what the model is estimating. So they're kind of, if you think about models, there's always what the model fits, and then there's a lack of fit. So in this case, the model has some lack of fit, some low values that are not captured within this overall smooth trend. And so this could be concerning for application of the model. You have to always have to look at when you're fitting a model to your data, you know, what's the lack of fit. And so we do have some lack of fit. The values are a little bit low, so you might still, this is still reasonable. We can probably live with that. Or you might want to understand, you know, why do we have these values that are below the overall trend at, you know, with a small frequency. About 1 out of every 10 or so of these samples is low. So it just raises some questions, and it's one of the good things to do when you're looking at your data. You have the data applied, and you can look at the model. You can see, you know, what is the fit and lack of fit of this model. Well, this is another pretty different kind of approach for temporal optimization, and this is actually out of the Meros software, which is the monitoring and remediation optimization. And what this is using is, this is kind of illustrating with this chart. So you're going to run a couple of different analyses. So let's just first look at the top here, which is from linear regression. So looking at the rate of change. The rate of change is high, medium, and low. And the rate of change is actually relative to a standard or an MCL that you've put into the software. So it's using the data that you have existing for your well, and you're looking at the trend. Is the trend high, meaning it's 2 times the MCL, or low, less than half the MCL? And then you can look at the what it has here in terms of the columns, and so it starts out with quarterly is where you have the highest rate of change. They're recommending you do quarterly sampling. And if you have a low trend, less than half the MCL or standard, then it's just once a year. And the other way, in essence, you can think about this as being refined is it's also doing the Mann-Kendall test, which is giving you information then on the trend direction. So the top here is an increasing trend, and the bottom is a decreasing trend. And so there's slightly more sampling recommended when you have an increasing high rate of change trend, in essence, with this chart-based method. And so I know this is one that you know, a lot of people have used for different projects. Okay, what about spatial optimization? So with spatial optimization, again, you could probably think about, you may basically do this at hand or do this with your software, and you can say, well, I can take out a well and I can see what effect it has on the results I get. So the idea is that you can say, well, are any wells giving you information that's basically redundant? It's the same information from neighboring wells. Or more difficult question is sometimes, well, where is there uncertainty in this plume? You know, where do we have not enough coverage in the wells? And knowing information about the plume mass or other aspects about the plume geometry. So conceptually, it's kind of easy. You can say, well, you can remove wells. That's easy to do. You can remove wells individually or in groups. Areas, like I said, with the higher uncertainty is sometimes more difficult, because if you have no data, then you may have conceptually no uncertainty, and then you may have to be going back to your conceptual site model. And I think that's another important thing to remember, is that when you're doing optimization, you really have to be doing it informed with the conceptual site model, especially for spatial optimization, but also for temporal optimization, because you have to understand, how many aquifer units you have and what their communication is, what the rate of flow of groundwater is, all that kind of thing. Okay, well, just this slide is illustrating, first of all, the tools, and just giving you kind of a simplistic look at, a hypothetical, portion of a site, really. And so here we have this N0 is kind of the focal well, and then we have these neighboring wells. And this is illustrating a particular kind of interpolation using these, there's Thiessen polygons, and these are called Delaney triangles and Voronoi diagrams, which are this polygon here in between. And it's basically going to use this information. If you have information at these different points, I can interpolate values in between. And for me, the other interesting thing that this points out is that, well, when we're doing spatial optimization or any kind of spatial work, that one important thing to realize is edge effects. In this particular case, it illustrates there's a lot of edge, because basically in this little snippet of this area, all these wells around N0 are on an edge. There's nothing around these to understand what the levels are. This is obviously just a portion of probably a monitoring network, but at some point you get to the edge of the monitoring network and you have to use specific methods. When you get to an edge, the edge might be a physical boundary, and or the edge might be just where I have no data. There's no wells out that far. So that with that consideration of that important caveat is of edge effects, you can apply different kinds of methods. So one set of methods is are called genetic algorithms, and these are actually really have nothing to do with evolution or biology, but they're computer programming algorithms. Because when you get to large networks or fairly large networks, it can be very difficult to, by hand, go through and determine the optimum position of wells. And so that's what these methods are helping you do, is they actually go through and try to find an optimal solution. And the GTS Smart is in the GTS software, which is the Geostatistical Temporal Spatial software, and that's the method it uses, which is based on some genetic algorithms. Some other things that are a little bit simpler are the slope factors and relative errors. You can also use geospatial models like geostatistical models like Kriging. There's a Kriging uncertainty, and then there's, of course, if you have a fairly simple network, a qualitative evaluation may be sufficient. You don't need to go and use other software tools to understand what might happen with removing wells in particular. Well, where you have to add wells, it's a more difficult problem. And in some sense, you have to do some sort of interpolation. You have to do some estimation and look for where there are areas of higher uncertainty and perhaps where you have fewer wells. And so this is just a screenshot from this GTS, Geostatistical Temporal Spatial software, and that we have some more information on that tool. Another one's in Appendix D, 8.6. So this screenshot just meant to illustrate a couple things. So what the GTS is doing is it starts with, you can import information on your site, like this plan view information, and all these pluses here, the green pluses throughout here and here, those are all your existing monitoring well network locations. And then what GTS is doing initially is it's taking your data and it's going to do this interpolation and extrapolation, because you're a little bit outside the domain of the wells here, and it's going to come up with these circles. So the circles are the estimates of uncertainty, coefficient of variation at these different locations. And you can see that there are nested ones, these locations. You can see there's two different circles there. Those are two different contaminants we have. So it can handle more than one contaminant. When there appears to be just one circle, it just means that the uncertainty of that location for both of them is low. So that's a helpful thing that it can do. And it can basically, we can now visually say, well, here's some areas, there's some very large circles here, and there's a limited amount of the network, especially over in this area. So this would be an area where you might be looking at more wells, just more qualitative looking at this information from GTS. And like I said, GTS can also help you position wells using its own genetic algorithm tools. Well, to kind of sum up with optimization in general for most cases is not going to be done manually. You're actually going to have to use programming tools. And so there are a number that we have reviewed in the web-based guidance document. I've listed some of them here. And they go from the ones that are slightly more simple to the ones that are more complicated. And they have some different assumptions built into them. So the Meros, for example, is the one that uses more of the slope factor. I think they do use some kriging now. VST does both temporal and spatial optimization, but it does them separately. So you have to basically iterate with that tool if you want to do them together. And as the name suggests, GTS can actually do both this temporal and spatial optimization for you in one package. And I think with that, we're turning it back over to Harold.
Okay, thank you, Randall. And so as we do a summary today, I first want to talk about some more of what is in our web-based document. We have three other sections that are fairly important that we discussed in the training today that I wanted to point out. And so the first one is the statistical methods test under section 5. What we've done as a team is we've grouped the different statistical methods into their application so that we might pick like if you were to go to trends, well, it would list the different methods that are used to establish trends, to analyze for trends, and what it does for each method is it gives the application relevant study questions that it can determine, and the assumptions that are needed for that trend method, the requirements, and the strengths and the weaknesses. And like I pointed out before, this is not a how-to, but just a resource web document, and more importantly, then we would link to the unified guidance on explaining how to do that method or what some more assumptions or weaknesses or strengths might be with that method. Next, as Randall discussed, and as many people have asked questions about, in Appendix D of our web-based document, we've put together a summary of some software packages. And what the team did back a couple years ago was sent out a survey asking what different people used in their analysis of groundwater data and their own, and then the team's own expertise, deciding on, yeah, these are the 23 most popular ones, and so we limited it to this group here as to the different software packages, and then the team went ahead and contacted the software manufacturer or developer and got different factors about the software, and then also used their personal knowledge as to some of the limitations or ease of use of these documents. So that in any case, in Appendix D, you can pick out one of the software packages, and it'll give you the approximate cost of that software package, the requirements for it, the ease of use, and how you import the data and different factors, and then, of course, the references. There are other software packages or applications that can use statistical methods described in this document, and you should be careful in reviewing any software to be sure that it's applicable to the needs before you use it in your statistical evaluation and manage your data. Some of the packages were designed for environmental data, and others are more general software packages for business or scientific application. Each summary includes some of the practical information, such as, you know, as the approximate cost and its capabilities. In any case, when you the capabilities, then the team went a little bit further, and this is a screenshot of one of the software packages, and we went through each statistical method and what the capability of that software package was to evaluate that method. So in this software case, it had the full circles mean it has full capability, half circle means it has limited capability, and if there's no circle, it has no capability. So in this case, in handling non-detect, it has full capability in selecting a simple substitution method and has limited access or abilities to use the Cohen's approximation method, and then no capability of doing the Kaplan-Meier method. So we would suggest and recommend that if you have specific tests that you want to run, that you might go to the different software packages and see what their capabilities are and use this as kind of a guideline for your selection of the software package that you might want to use for your analysis. And then, if you remember, we talked about the grounding in your groundwater data. One of the big challenges is having an adequate software package or having an adequate database set up so that you can handle your data efficiently. The first step, I think, as we've all pointed out, all the trainers have pointed out, is that you get your data quality objective procedure down so that you know which data is the essential data to have and what you want to save in your database. Then we want to point out that I think almost all laboratories now will give you back the results in a format, electronic formatted database, so that some of the bigger ones, such as the Department of Defense and EPA, you know, we give examples of those software packages as to what the format is for those databases. But in any case, you need to establish the database that you want to have, get a basic structure for that, and then that will help you in streamlining your data analysis. So in this course, we hope that you have become more confident in dealing with statistical concepts, better able to appropriately select your statistical methods for your project and the appropriate tools for your software tools for your project. We would strongly recommend that you use this web-based document in establishing those different selections. Next of all, Randall and Liz got you ready to apply the statistics in four key areas, in establishing background and determining compliance of your groundwater data, in doing a trend analysis of your data, and then doing monitoring optimization. And in any case, we strongly recommend that you go to the web-based document, as we show here, the URL, the address for that document, and that you put that in your toolbox for analyzing groundwater data. And with that, I will turn it over to Juliana for your additional question.
Thank you, Harold. We do now have time for questions, so anyone is welcome to enter questions in that Q&A pod in the lower right. I also have a couple of poll questions for you to answer as we finish up today's training class. Are you ready to use statistics to better understand groundwater data at your sites? And also, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So as we're asking questions, you're welcome to fill out those polls. And again, everyone is welcome to look at answers as other people are entering them. I'll also remind you, we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. We're going to use your feedback, not only to improve this course, but also as we offer new courses, we do incorporate the feedback that you provide. And we've got several new courses that we're developing right now. So your feedback goes directly into helping those trainers improve what we're going to offer to you in the future. So we do ask that you please complete the feedback form. And we have a link here on the slide. It's the third bullet down. The feedback is also your opportunity to get a certificate. So if you want a certificate for attending today, fill out the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. And if you have more than one person at your location, there's a link where you can go back, and each person at your location can get their own certificate for participating today. We also have additional links to additional resources, and that's your path to find the guidance document that we've talked about during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes something that you use in your work. Also, I've added another item, register for geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites training. So that's the last bullet here on slide 92. That is going to be offered next week, January 30. It's a great class, and I do encourage you to review the information that is available about the class. And if it's something that you think is useful, please register now for the training class. And again, for all of ITRC upcoming classes, we have classes planned for the rest of January and in February. I do encourage you to register now, especially those classes that are coming up in February. I do expect registration to fill. So if you'd like a slot, go ahead and register now for the class. We had a couple of questions that came in with the first question and answer break that we didn't get to, so I'll go through those first. How do you use percentiles in statistical decision making?
Well, I guess I'll try and answer. You can use percentiles as, in many different ways. Of course, we talked about in our box plots using the median, which was the 50th percentile. So I guess and there's certainly some regulatory requirements that lead you to using percentiles. So there's really no real difference. A percentile is just a type of statistic, so you could form confidence limits for that. There's statistical intervals around that percentile if you wanted to take that kind of approach, or use hypothesis tests to test whether certain percentiles were below or above or below regulatory limits. So, that's just kind of you could kind of use the same general approaches with percentiles.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for answering. I actually was talking and then I realized I was on mute.
Okay. But,
the only thing I'd add to that is, the UTL, the upper tolerance limit, those are actually, it's a confidence limit on a percentile, so those are used pretty commonly. And then Liz had her Washington State example where it's a specific regulation. So.
Liz's landfill example seemed to follow the EPA unified guidance in its use of both interwell and intrawell comparisons. Do you feel that it is appropriate to prescriptively require one over the other as a default?
Liz, do you want to take that one? Or are you still on?
Sorry, I was on mute. I think that was actually Chris's example.
Okay.
Well, you know, I guess you kind of have to follow what the regulations tell you to do, generally speaking. I don't have any strong feelings about what should be prescribed. I mean, I think different approaches are appropriate for different situations, but often I think more than one approach could work, and I'd encourage people to try them out. So in other words, try out both approaches and kind of see if you get similar results or not. That's also kind of the case for parametric and non-parametric tests. Often it's easy enough to just do them both and see if you get the same answer, then you can feel more confident. And if you don't get the same answer, then you kind of have, it's a clue that you perhaps should look into it further.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I don't have the specific example in front of me, but I don't think it's appropriate to prescriptively require one over the other, because I think it depends on the specific situation.
One of our participants says, great seminar. What's the best organization to join to learn more about environmental statistics? So do trainers have any recommendations for organizations that perhaps you're a member of?
I don't have anything specific for statistics in particular.
Well, I mean, is the American Statistical Association, which is a, general professional organization for statisticians, and they do have a journal that's focused on environmental statistics, but in general, I guess there's nothing really designed for sort of more practical applications of environmental statistics that I'm aware of.
Yeah, I was drawing a little bit of blank too. ASA is obvious if you're a statistician. I guess it depends on whether or not you're a statistician or more of a practitioner, and I guess depends on if your interest is mainly in groundwater, then you can, there's groundwater organizations to become members of. And if you're just interested in the topic, as Chris said, there is a journal topical area for ASA where they do environmental stats.
Questions come in. Can I apply the methods we talked about today for a site cleanup project involving soils?
That's a good question. I think some of the, or a lot of the methods overlap considerably. The main thing might be, in general, with soils, the time series does not apply as much, but and it's generally more spatial oriented. So I guess that's another plug for the GRO course if you're interested in spatial statistics. But yeah, there, a lot of the methods would apply. I mean, certainly one of the plots that Chris was illustrating and Liz, they're all applicable to soil data, box plots are.
Thank you. We are out of time for today's class, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. If you have a question that we either haven't answered yet, or if you come up with a question, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with trainers to get an answer to your questions. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today.